Welcome to the 27th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Jeff Boycott this week asked the English cricketing media to stop being crybabies after the Pakistan whitewash. Welcome to the podcast where there are very rarely tears.
One of the things that's been making me particularly happy over the last week is the fact that Syed Ajmal, obviously the architect to a large extent of the whitewash, has been cleared of chucking officially by the ECC. It's a wonderful story, a post-match interview he gave after the third test, in which he seemed to tell the BBC that he'd been given some kind of special dispensation from the ICC to chuck, effectively. And it's always a pity when you see someone who's clearly a great proponent of their art, clearly a bit of a mystery bowler, who's so consistently undermined by talk about the potential that he's chucking. We saw it with Muralitharan, and it's really nice to see the fact that he's now, you know, the ICC, and all credit to the ICC, have come out and have definitively said, no, he's not a chucker, and now we can just get on and enjoy watching him bowl.
Well, I think it's the Murali example is the best one, where you have someone who's achieving something very special in the game, who's really giving certainly fans a huge amount of pleasure, and yet always it's being undermined and slightly being sniped at. So I think, it's very timely, actually, for Ajmal to gain his kind of his clearance as such. I think for me, the most exciting event of the last fortnight was sort of away from the major contests, Afghanistan's one-off game against Pakistan. I mean, I think there's been so much coverage of Afghanistan's story that we've kind of forgotten quite how remarkable it is. I don't think any country in the world has gone through quite as much upheaval as Afghanistan. And somehow, in the midst of that, they've put together a very competitive cricket team who actually presented themselves pretty well against Pakistan. We talk about how Pakistan have come on as a test side. They're, if anything, a better one-day side than they are a test side. And yet Afghanistan showed lots of fight. Their top order in particular really went after Pakistan's seamers. Their bowlers weren't humiliated.
It was nice as well to see the fact that the ICC gave... I mean, we're giving the ICC a lot more praise now than we usually do. But the ICC gave them the opportunity to play this game. And it actually kind of makes it more sort of permeable between test nations and other nations, the fact that we now have a bit more of a mix going on, which I think is really nice. There's a sort of a sad story about the way that test nations are sort of integrating, which is that Zimbabwe going to New Zealand and being absolutely thrashed has kind of raised the question as to whether there are now three tiers to test cricket. I mean, we've talked for a long time about there being two tiers, with the India, England, Australia, Sri Lanka's in the top, and then the likes of New Zealand, Bangladesh in the bottom. Now, I mean, if Zimbabwe aren't going to be beating New Zealand, then who are they going to be beating? And they lost absolutely horrifically in both the tests and the one days. And so it's quite disappointing to see that this kind of separation within the test hierarchy.
Well, I think it's when we talk about how good it is that the ICC have gave Afghanistan a chance, they've given Zimbabwe a chance, I mean, a real opportunity, several one days, even a test match against New Zealand, and it's hard not to feel Zimbabwe have blown it. In the future, for example, it's going to be harder for Zimbabwe to make the case that they deserve these games, just because they've been... I mean, the test display in particular was pathetic. I mean, they were bowled out twice within a day. And it's sad because I think they showed an awful lot of promise against Bangladesh. But that promise, I mean, clearly the journey back is going to be maybe a lot longer than some of us thought. I guess my sort of disappointing moment the last 2 weeks has been IPL-based. Generally, I've done a pretty good job at just ignoring the IPL. I don't really like it. It's, you know, feel free to watch it if you must, but it's never really captured my attention. I mean, mainly just remembering who plays for who has been enough of a challenge. But anyway, the auction was insane to the point of irritating. The valuation of players just seems to me to be completely upturning the way cricket players are valued. In terms of it, the money value seems to have very little relation to ability in so many cases. Ravindra Jadeja, who's a half-decent left-arm spinner, has gone for $2 million. Sunil Nareen, West Indian, with just four first-class appearances, $700,000. And again, in what kind of a world does Andre Russell, who, you know, a talented-ish West Indian bowler, go for $450,000, whereas the fairly prodigious-looking Darren Bravo goes for just $100,000? There's something about this that seems to be... Players, I don't object to players being very well paid for their talent, but the valuing seems to be really messing up the kind of natural order of things.
I suppose it's something that we see in football quite a lot, the way that this sort of transfer market works and the way that there's a lot of intrigue and a lot of sort of dirty dealing almost that goes on behind the scenes for players to be transferred from one team to another. And it's not something we're used to seeing in cricket. And I think, as you said, it hasn't really worked on the IPL basis. There are a lot of strange judgments coming through. So, from the archives and this episode, Andy's going to be telling us about England's wicket-keeping dilemma.
I think for me, English wicket-keeping always begins with a hat in my mind, more specifically a sun hat. Michael Atherton tells a very good story about how he asked Jack Russell if it would be okay for him possibly to wear the official team cap, and Russell said no. Atherton said, is there any possible compromise we could come to? Russell said no, which probably tells you a lot about what you need to know about Jack Russell. He's kind of become notorious as sort of one of the last real cricketing eccentrics as sort of professionalism kicked in. He was also a very good wicketkeeper and particularly well known, actually particularly later in his career actually for Gloucestershire, as someone who could stand up to the wicket to even some sort of pretty quick bowlers. He was never actually certainly a long way short of being a great batsman. He finished his career with a test average of 27. Did a very nice line in sort of very defiant batting, though. A rather brilliant 29 off 229 balls against South Africa. But the interesting thing about Russell's career is that it became very much part of him versus Alex Stewart. That became a very big selection dilemma for England throughout the 90s. And Stewart, in many ways, was the complete antithesis of Russell. He's a very much a professional's professional. And he was in the side as a batsman first and foremost. He was in the side because he could make regular runs. And then he was asked to kind of keep wicket, mainly because of this idea of the balance of the side. England was struggling, as they perennially were throughout the 90s, and there was a sense that really having Russell in the team was kind of a luxury, whereas you have Stewart, you get him to keep wicket as well, and it kind of frees up the slot. And it really started to show, I think, a lot of how England's selectors' thinking changed, that they increasingly started to stick with Stewart.
I suppose it's one of those, it's the perennial debate whether you go with a batting keeper or a keeping batsman. And one of the things that always seemed to me with Stewart that England were doing was effectively saying, OK, we've got a really weak middle order. We can't afford to just have a keeper in on their keeping skills alone. And rather than building a team around a keeper and a keeper's skills, as happened with Russell, they basically were saying, OK, we need to make double use of this slot, as it were, so that you couldn't afford to have someone batting in your middle order who wasn't a particular batsman, a really good batsman, or in the case of Stewart, someone batting at the top of the order who wasn't a really good batsman. So it's that really sort of practical consideration that seemed to come to the fore, I think, of the selectors' minds there.
And I think perhaps a winning team, it would have been a much easier decision. A winning team maybe could have afforded to keep Russell. It clearly had an impact on Stewart, though. And this is perhaps the other thing that wasn't so much thought about. Stewart, as batsman only, averaged almost 47 at test level, which actually, particularly in the 90s, which were very much more bowler-dominated time in test cricket, was superb. As a keeper alone, he averaged less than 35. So you did see, it was maybe the thing the selectors didn't perhaps give enough thought to, was that picking Stewart the keeper was actually, you were picking a considerably weaker player almost than picking Stewart just the pure batsman. Chris Reid was very soon seen as Alex Stewart's sort of natural successor. Even as sort of a very, very young player, he was very soon sort of seen as the country's outstanding glovesman. And I think it was England were desperate to show that they were new, to show that they were kind of reviving the side with youngsters. So he was thrown into test side at just 21. And whereas his keeping clearly was up to the challenge, his batting clearly wasn't. And I almost wonder whether the harm done through that early start has actually constantly impacted on Reid's career since. It became characterised by this infamous dismissal against Chris Cairns when he ducked a slower ball Yorker and was clean bowled, and it was just humiliating for Reid. It was embarrassing, and it showed a batsman frankly out of confidence and with no belief in his own ability. The interesting thing about it's been a decade really where England selectors have done so well, frankly. They've consistently got the big calls right. They've consistently known when to back players. And I think there's a case for saying Chris Reed has been treated worse than almost any other player. Three different stints in the side. They've never quite known what to do with him.
And it's not just Reed as well. I'm thinking James Foster is another example of someone who's a very good glovesman, but has been sort of in and out of the side. And I think it's actually a mark of when you, I mean, as you say, exactly, throughout the first decade of the 2000s, England's selection was on the whole very good and on the whole very consistent. And the one thing where it hasn't been really, with a couple of notable exceptions, is with keepers. And it just, I think, points to the fact that keepers really are seen as the linchpin of the side. And I think they became that very much for England. When you see Geraint Jones being selected regularly, the fact was that England couldn't afford to have, in a middle order where you had Flintoff batting at 5 or 6, you needed your keeper to be able to bat. Otherwise, it looked like a very, very flaky middle order.
So I think, and I mean, it was interesting to bring Foster in as well. I think with Reed and Foster, you've got two very talented glovesmen. And you had, obviously, there was part of the England committee that wanted that, that were keen for that, but yet couldn't quite bring themselves to back those players consistently. I think in many ways, Geraint Jones is the most fascinating keeper England I've had over the last 15 years. His career is actually, his test career is kind of characterised generally by quite consistent mediocrity. He finished with, after 34 tests, finished with an average of just 23, which frankly, if you talk about someone now, and we'll come to him in a moment, you know, if someone like Matt Prior averaged anything, you know, he wouldn't be close to the side. And at the same time, Jones's keeping was not up to much. He was very erratic. He dropped an awful lot. And yet England stuck with him. And what's interesting, when you look at the best statistics, as we've just done, his career doesn't sound like much. But actually, I think when a lot of cricket fans, well, of our generation and not just of our generation, look back on Geraint Jones, they've got some incredibly glorious moments. There's that wonderful partnership, that wonderful rearguard action with Flintoff at the fourth Ashes test in 2005. They put on 177, turned that game, possibly turned the series. And then, of course, there's the Kasparovic catch, which, you know, sealed the victory at Edgbaston. So I think Geraint Jones is this rather extraordinary case where you look back on his statistics and think, well, he wasn't much of a player, and yet he was either lucky enough or just able to deliver great performances at key moments, such that I think a lot of England fans will look back with him with at least a degree of fondness. Interesting as well, it was an interesting example where Duncan Fletcher backed him. And Fletcher, who was so keen on this idea of like 360 degree cricketer who can do everything, sounds like maybe too much to ask, but who can do everything, seemed to really back Jones, seemed to really believe in him. I think with, and I've not quite been comprehensive here, we realised we've missed out Tim Ambrose, but you know, someone had to go. But coming to Matt Prior, I think Matt Prior's selection in many ways represents sort of the resolution of the dilemma. And it's been very much resolved in terms of a preference for a batsman. It was very clear when Prior was selected that he was selected first and foremost as someone who would contribute a lot of runs in the middle order. His wicket-keeping was not the reason he was selected for. Yet his keeping has been quite interesting to see develop. When he was initially dropped from the England side after a difficult bit of batting in the subcontinent, he came back into the side after a period in county cricket, much improved as a keeper. And I think what Prior had shown is that competency in wicketkeeping is very much learnable. He will never be a keeper with the kind of almost instinctive brilliance of a Foster or a Reed, but yet he has been able to prove himself very competent in the role.
And I think, in a sense, if you look across world cricket, Prior is one of a sort of new breed of keeper, because I can't, off the top of my head, think of a keeper, a regular test keeper for another Test nation, who is a brilliant glovesman of the nature of Chris Reed. Sangakkara certainly isn't. I mean, these are all though. I mean, you know, Dhoni. I think, you know, people like Gilchrist, for instance, going back a bit. They are all first and foremost, like Prior, very, very good batsmen who were also, you know, good enough glovesmen, and then worked on their glove work throughout their careers and became, you know, towards the end of it, very good all round keepers, but were selected primarily as batsmen, I think.
And I think the interesting thing is, we mentioned at the start, I mean, Jack Russell was dropped from a losing England side. If England feel even at their best, with a really strong batting order and a really strong bowling lineup, that they cannot afford to carry a specialist wicketkeeper, then I think, sadly, it says something very bad about the fate of very talented pure keepers. It's getting harder and harder to see a role for them, perhaps, in the international game. But I think you look at someone like Pryor, and he's being judged as a batsman. The guy has a test average of almost 45. It's that that he's made his name for, and what I guess he'll be remembered for. To the book review, and this episode we're going to be looking at the autobiography of perhaps one of the most talented but also one of the most divisive figures in English cricket. It's Boycott, the autobiography.
In many ways this is typical Boycott. You go through the entire book feeling that the writer is on the defensive, that he has an axe to grind throughout it. And it's very much, I mean, if you want a history of English cricket in the 60s, 70s, 80s, do not turn to this book. This is Geoffrey Boycott telling things his way. This is Geoffrey Boycott getting, at times, painfully personal in terms of telling players how awful he thought they were. There's a wonderful, when he's describing when Mike Dennis took over the England captaincy in the West Indies, he pulls absolutely no punches in telling Dennis, the world, everyone, how absolutely appalling and unsuited as a captain he ever was. And so there's this sort of really defensive streak to the whole book, which made it for me actually quite a difficult and quite an annoying read at times.
I mean, I think we've talked before on the podcast, because we inevitably do end up looking at quite a few autobiographies, and we talked before about kind of the different style of book, and axe grinding is, you know, the word to define this one. The thing is, Boycott's career did give him a lot of axes to grind. I mean, and a lot of the time, and perhaps early on in the book, I found it very easy to feel a certain amount of sympathy for him. His treatment by Yorkshire was often horrendous. His treatment by the media was particularly bad. The problem is that after a lot of these instances, and after he describes each of them in minute details as to why he was right, they were wrong, it does get tedious. I mean, I think the one thing you do get out of it is you get an astonishing portrait of a man who basically felt the victim constantly. I mean, he played his entire career under siege, or at least he felt it like that. And I think, you know, psychologically, you learn something quite interesting about the man from that.
One of the things that I've never really... I haven't spent, obviously, prolonged periods watching Boycott. His playing days were before I was thought of, before we were both thought of. And one of the things that I found quite lacking from this book was any description of his sort of on-field play, other than when it keyed into these kind of controversies. So there's a description, for instance, of when he's in, I think it's 73, in the West Indies, when Mike Dennis has been made captain, and the West Indies are 1-0 up going into the fourth and final test. England have managed just to scrape through a couple of tests in the middle. And Boycott, in the last test, Tony Gregg takes lots of wickets and Boycott scores lots of runs. And Boycott comes out with the amazing admission that it crossed his mind to throw his wicket away so that England would lose the test, so that Dennis's captaincy wouldn't in some way be confirmed by the fact that they'd managed to square the series against the West Indies. And it's only in instances like that that you actually get any real description of innings or of Boycott in the middle, and that's one of the things that I felt was really missing from it, because he was clearly a fantastically sort of influential and talented batsman, and there's little insights from him about that.
I mean, I think as close as he ever gets to talking about the mental processes behind his batting, he always talks about this idea of not wanting to give it away, of being proud that he didn't give it away, and you get the idea, I mean, that he always batted almost in defiance. And I guess, you know, that fits in very much with the defensive style. I think, as I said, what was missing is, you know, how he clearly was mentally extremely strong. How did he keep his focus in the wicket? There was a kind of level of insight that was missing. I mean, sort of going back to the axe grinding, I think the one perhaps most legitimate axe he has to grind in the entire book, he talks about when he was dropped for slow scoring against India in a test match. And this was the point where I felt he's rarely angrier than at this point in the book. He clearly, you know, you can almost hear him steaming off the page. And I think what you do realise is you realise how far sort of team selection has come and how far, you know, how much more professional and frankly fairer it is than now. The fact that Brian Close and the selectors seem to really just conspire against boycott in this case, and he was ended up accusing of sort of having disobeyed captain's orders when, you know, he certainly claims to have done no such thing. And you struggle to come up with a scenario now where an English batsman would play extremely well under pressure and then be dropped for slow scoring. There's something really very painful about it. In terms of him as the individual, there's a rather telling anecdote early on where he talks about how he just, it's not so much an anecdote, I guess, it's just a sort of detail, where he talks about how he just didn't really go to the bar with the other players. He didn't like beer. For him, his passion was cricket, and he was willing to always put that first. And it's interesting to think, well, to what extent that did alienate him from his fellow professionals, not spending time with them, what impression they got of him because he chose not to spend time with him. It's an interesting one because it's the side of the game that we never see in terms of how a team is built.
In short, I think in order sort of to get the most out of this book, you have to, and in order to learn the most about boycott, you don't do that by sort of taking literally what he says. A lot can be learned by reading between the lines and looking at the things that he keeps on talking about lengthily. There are some very, very interesting, I mean, we keep on going back to this idea of the axe grinding and of him being defensive, but there are very, very interesting descriptions of him as a child and his father, who was a miner and was involved in what sounds like a horrific mining accident, and his pelvis is smashed and, you know, his legs are completely written off. And there's a sense of, you know, from the beginning and throughout the book of boycott against the world, I think, really.
It's rather well summarised. He very early on in the book, talking about getting his Yorkshire cap, he finishes one of his chapters saying, "Nothing was given easily at Yorkshire," which is precisely as it should be. And I think there in that line is boycott's approach to life. Everything was hard won and hard fought. To the debate, and this episode, after England's rather chastening experience in Abu Dhabi, we're going to be asking, is the subcontinent the final frontier only in England's minds?
For me, much of England's problems in the subcontinent are indeed mental. One of the distinctive features, I think, about the series in the UAE was the fact that actually a lot of the pitches didn't spin. And that the person who was most successful in the series, Syed Ajmal, seemed to be actually also the best person at playing mind games, effectively, with all the hype that he built up around the series. That's just a limited example, and I think there are sort of endemic problems that England mentally have about playing in the subcontinent as well. One of which is that there is this constant thought, whether it's right or not, that a winning formula that is a winning formula anywhere else in the world doesn't apply to the subcontinent. So when, straight after having thrashed the world number one side, India, 4-0 over the summer, England straight away was saying, OK, we've done that, now there's a final frontier, we're not a good side until we succeeded in the subcontinent. And there seems to be this mental inability to say we are a good side in and of ourselves, and to say, you know, actually that it depends on circumstance. And I think, of course, it does to an extent, but I think that there is also a way in which when you've looked in the recent series in the UAE, but also throughout the last decade with England playing in the subcontinent, there seems to be a way in which, for instance, the way that England have approached structuring innings, batting, which has served them so well in all parts of the world, they just seem to forget about that. And it's the way that you see the panic look of the England middle order when they're playing against Ajmal, which is that they could usually actually handle him quite well. The problem was that it just ended up with them sort of getting impatient, heaving horrifically across the line, and sort of having a sort of mental disintegration that they didn't trust themselves to be actually able to play like that.
I mean, I think it's oversimplifying it to say that it is purely a kind of mental frontier. I think it's really important to recognise quite how hard and quite how different cricket in this, playing cricket in the subcontinent is. I mean, I think it's worth recognising It's been a final frontier, not just for England, but of course for that very successful Aussie team of the 90s and 2000s. For them, it was a huge challenge. I mean, that was an incredibly mentally strong side. I think the key thing is, and this is true for batsmen and bowlers, you are being asked to alter your game quite drastically, I think, in subcontinent conditions. For me, the most relevant example in the recent series is you look at someone like Andrew Strauss, who has had an awful lot of success primarily through playing off the back foot, primarily through effective pulling and cutting, and suddenly found himself trying to play in a similar way in the subcontinent and coming very undone very quickly. The other point is this issue of, I accept the fact that it's not always turning pitches. I mean, you don't always get these extraordinary pitches in a sort of like Kandy in Sri Lanka where the ball would just do whatever Murali wanted it to do. But you also often just get these very slow pitches. And I think this, if anything, is the bigger problem. And I think it was best exemplified by England's performance in the 2011 World Cup. England didn't know how to force the pace in Indian conditions. They would often go through periods of very slow scoring and then simply throw wickets away out of desperation. Key abilities, just like knocking it around, finding the gaps, or even trying to go over the top at the start of innings, didn't happen. I think the other final issue is this issue of spinners that are used to playing in English conditions and build up a reputation in English conditions, and I'm really thinking of Graham Swann here in particular. It's a challenge going to the subcontinent and having to adapt to those conditions. And you do have to bowl differently. And what's worked for Swann in England hasn't necessarily worked, well, hasn't worked for him, frankly, in the most recent series.
I think, though, that essentially both sides have to play on the same pitch. So it's not as though, you know, England are playing on a pitch that doesn't turn and Pakistan are bowling on a pitch that does turn. And I realise that's a slightly flippant point, and I realise, in a sense, this whole topic of whether it's a mental or a practical thing that England have fallen down with in the subcontinent, as a topic, is a bit silly, because it's kind of a bit of both. But what I would say is that, and again, this is a slightly silly thing to say, but is that actually I think it's a slightly mental thing that England don't adapt when they go. I mean, Graham Swann is a good enough spin bowler to realise that he needs to bowl more wicket to wicket in, you know, the UAE when he's going to be bowling on pitches that might have a bit of turn, are going to be slower, and when you've got, crucially for this, you've got the DRS as well giving a lot of LB decisions. And I think there's a kind of idea that it's sort of either we have to play our own game. We, you know, Strauss saying, I have to play back. That's the way I play. That's what I'm going to do regardless of. And I think that's actually a mental thing. He can play forward very successfully. I suppose there's just one other thing, which is that when I'm always slightly, I agree absolutely that it's a different set of playing conditions, physically a different set of playing conditions in the subcontinent. But just as, for instance, England didn't beat Australia at Lord's for the best part of 50 years or however long it was, you wouldn't put that down to something physical. That is something mental. And I think there must be an extent to which England are thinking, essentially sort of take their eye off the ball in a sense. They think, we can't win in the subcontinent. We need to either do something drastic or we need to stonewall and just, you know, play our usual game, as the phrase goes.
I mean, I think there's a flip side to this, which is that England's victory, for example, over India last summer was built on the fact that England were excellent, yes, but also that India just could not adapt to English conditions. They couldn't adapt. They struggled desperately to deal with, frankly, just the swinging ball. So I think there's a flip side to that, that obviously Pakistan in Abu Dhabi were a far greater side than even this current improved Pakistan would be in English conditions. So you're getting that sort of flip side of it. I just think what does frustrate me, and I guess this is both a mental thing and just a practical technique thing, is when England went to that 2011 World Cup, they'd known for years that it was going to be in India. They knew the World Cup they were preparing for, and yet they had no strategy in place for how to score quick runs in Indian conditions. And I think that was the biggest frustration, that you think, well, we knew that this was where the World Cup was going to be. We know lots of teams that play effectively in this condition. Why did England get to that tournament still with no kind of plan, no kind of strategy for dealing with it?
Thanks for listening to the 27th episode of Reverse Prep Radio. Do join us again in another couple of weeks when we'll have more cricketing fun and frolics.